Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowring. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we sit down in a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these folks. Conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today, we are talking to Suzanne Arnold. Welcome, Suzanne, to Zero Hour. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yes. Before we get started, I just wanted to read a little bit of information about you and your background. You're a Richmond-based artist, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And who loves to sort of explore the overlay of cultural memory and personal experience in her work, utilizing a personal vocabulary of images and ancient painting techniques. Talk about that a little bit, and then we'll get into some more of the background about you. But what does that mean to you, explore the overlay of cultural memory and personal experience in her work, utilizing encaustic?
Well, you know, if you grow up in a household like I did with lots of old things.
Really? Like what kinds of old things?
Furniture, old houses, stories about families that were on both sides of the Civil War. You try to sort of distance yourself, but it comes back.
Yeah.
And what you get is this overlay of past and present. And I think that that's a particularly Virginian, Southern sort of thing.
So you grew up in Virginia?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
All righty.
And was not very interested in any of that old history for many years. And then you find that in order to find out who you are, you need to kind of find out who your family was.
That's interesting. When did that start?
Actually, it started in high school with the book God's Graves and Scholars about archaeology. It was one of the first sort of popular books on archaeology.
Right.
And it just, it hit a chord. And that kind of interest in the past and digging out, finding the past, not only has it fascinated me, but since it's usually on the inside page of the newspaper, it obviously is fascinating to many, many people.
What's on that page of a newspaper?
Any archaeological discovery.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
When Taylor Dabney and I did an exhibit with an archaeological theme, I started cutting out articles from paper to find out, you know, where this interest came from.
Yeah.
Was it just something personal, or was it much broader than that? And I found that it was extensive throughout our culture, that we are fascinated with the ancient past and even the close past.
Yeah.
When you look at Antiques Roadshow,
people save
everything.
Yeah.
I'm a collector. I'm a scavenger. My house is just full of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And when I get ready to start on a work, some idea hits me, and I go digging through all these old things, and I will find, oh, yes, here's the article I was looking for. Here's the picture I was looking for.
Can you give me an example of that?
Well, a lot of my work has been about archaeology as a metaphor for this kind of overlay of past and present.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that interested me was because you look in a book or you look in the paper and you see a photograph that someone's taken of an archaeologist and he's digging up the past, but his cat's there, his dog's there, his wife's sitting over there.
Right.
They've got a sandwich wrapped there. That, you know, so you've got all this mixture of cultures and past and present, and nobody seems surprised at it.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting.
I found it intriguing.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that there were ways that I could use it.
Conceptually, also just in terms of the sense of time, the passage of time, the fact the archaeologist is, or at least was when the picture was taken, in the present, but engrossed in the past.
Exactly.
And exploring the past. And it's interesting.
And the past becomes almost, for that moment, more important
right
than the present.
Yeah.
And then as you go on, there's so many images in my head, so many thoughts from the period of time that I've gone through.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of years ago, there was a terrible fire behind my house, across the alley. And I really thought we were going to lose all our houses. Everything was fine, but it was one of the scariest moments I can remember. And soon after that, I went and did a residency, artist residency in Southwest Virginia. And I started putting fire into these pictures mm-hmm. of excavations,
mm-hmm.
where the excavators are very sort of dreamlike. In other mm-hmm. words, they're not paying any attention to this enormous fire in the background.
Right.
And then I started putting a mushroom cloud in it. And it brought back memories. Very small.
Duck and cover.
And yes, you went under your seat at school.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I thought, where in the world is all of this coming from?
Yeah.
And somebody said to me, well, don't you think that maybe it's that fire? And I said, it never occurred to me.
Yeah, yeah, traumatic, traumatic thing.
Traumatic, mm-hmm. but a means of making a picture, of saying something, but it's so nonverbal, you're almost unaware of exactly mm-hmm. what it is you're trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
Does
that happen to you often? I mean, I know, you know, one of the challenges of this program, I've had people say to me, how do you talk to artists about, you know, their work? And I said, well, we don't sit around and talk about the colors of their paintings. We talk about kind of the process of it. But this whole sort of fascination with, I guess, the passage of time, the past, and then you said the way it's overlaid in the present. Future at all?
Yes. The painting is the whole idea of the painting is something that hopefully will last into the future.
Oh, okay.
And I think more and more as I've put people, animals that I know personally into mm-hmm. the painting, it's the idea that this isn't just the past, but it's also the present. It's that they're together, they're continuous. It's a non-ending circular pattern of life and death and renewal. And I think one of the things, before I get into that a little bit more in my current work, you mentioned encaustic. And
tell
encaustic
people,
is very much a part of this.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit, because I don't want to assume.
Well,
some
it's
people
a very ancient technique uh-huh. of painting. It was the earliest binder for paint. You have colors, you have dirt, mm-hmm. earth, minerals that are ground up to make colors.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to hold them onto the surface in some way.
Right.
And the two earliest means were fresco, where you use lime that made mm-hmm. a chemical reaction with the plaster that it was put on.
Right on the wall,
mm-hmm. and it stuck.
Right.
Before that, you had like charcoal, where mm-hmm. you had the cavemen,
right.
but that was sealed up and gradually became part of the wall
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Over
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
The other main method was to use beeswax, and it starts with the Egyptians. Bees were considered very sacred.
Mm-hmm.
because they produced so many things that were necessary mm. for life. But they also took that beeswax, which is an inert subject that does not change color from the sun like so many pigments do.
Mm.
For
okay.
an artist to have some permanent method of securing your painting, particularly if somebody's paying a lot of money for it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're doing a mummy, and you're doing it for a very, very wealthy son of an mm-hmm. emperor or something. Mm-hmm. You want it to last.
What do you mean if you're doing a mummy? What do you mean?
Well, some of the early cases, they the colors that were used in the mummies.
Oh, in the cases.
Yes. Okay. They mixed with wax in order to hot wax.
Right.
In order to get that paint to stay on the surface.
To stay on there. Right. Okay.
That method was then used later in tablets of wax in which they burnt in different shapes to form writing. Mm. And from that, they get the word to burn in caustikos. From that, you get encaustic, you get cauterize, you get cauterium, which was the tool. It's gone into medical. It goes into the word ink. So it really started and came popular as a method of writing.
So that's the, is that, are you still working in encaustic?
Yes.
You are.
And one of the interesting finds that was made in the past was that in the late 1800s, when they were discovering all of these wonderful things, there were these portraits. And they would save the mummy and throw the portrait away. These were very late Egyptian pieces, but they were painted by Greeks, and they were when Egypt was a Roman colony. Mm-hmm. So the portraits were of Romans. And somehow or other, this process became so permanent that the colors stayed bright through time. The Virginia Museum has several.
So they actually, I mean, when they, what time period we talk here where they were throwing these things away?
Well, late 1800s when they discovered them.
So they would discover a mummy, discover a portrait.
A late mummy. I mean, I'm talking about late Roman period.
Yeah.
And
there would be a portrait maybe somewhere in the crypt or whatever.
The late Romans.
And it held no interest to them?
Right.
Wow.
But somebody found them and saved them. And then they realized, particularly artists realized, hey, this paint has stayed brilliant throughout time. Mm-hmm. Isn't this a wonderful idea?
For thousands of years.
Oil paint has a shelf life.
Yeah.
It can be, it's brittle. The colors are fugitive, many of them.
Right.
So artists throughout time have tried to go back and try to use this technique. But it's a very difficult technique because you have to heat the wax in order to paint with it. It became, I guess it was all, there were some encaustic painters as late as the 6th century AD up in the Sinai region. Mm-hmm. But basically it stopped about the 2nd century AD. When all those hordes came in and took over Rome, and the artists had to pick up and go to Constantinople or wherever they could go, this was not a method that you could easily take with you.
Yeah, it was lost.
So they gradually developed watercolor and then went into doing the paper manuscripts.
Oh, okay. Oh, all right. So you mean when you're talking about when they figured out that paper was a way to do this?
Yes. They had developed paper. Okay. It was easy. You could transport it. But artists all the way along have gone back to what some of the early Roman writers who wrote about, they talked about the fact that there were paintings, that they were made with wax, that there were portraits, that there were large murals that used wax as a mean to preserve the colors.
Well, let's talk about some of your, I guess, more recent work, Earth, Bones, and Spirit Stones.
Okay.
You said as a Virginian, it is no accident that the images of the past and the present, memory and imagination overlap in my work, nor that current media stories and pictures of domestic and civil wars and natural disasters have resonance in my mind and studio. So, well, let's talk about that first comment first.
Well, how many paintings can an artist do in their lifetime? One of the things that an artist wants to do is to always be relevant and current, not reinvent themselves, and yet at the same time reinvent themselves as alive, creative people. And that means that sometimes you have to push yourself. Sometimes you have to experiment with other things. I had
like,
done...
Like, for instance?
Well, I had done... I had spent 15 years doing several large series of paintings and sculpture in a figurative, sort of rustic manner, using the encaustic both on paintings and on carved polystyrene that were attached to paintings.
Okay.
And while I could have kept on making those paintings and those sculptures, you kind of get an itch. And I call it a sideline, you know, a sidebar.
Yeah.
The whole time you're doing your major work, other ideas are coming to you. Mm-hmm. And you kind of store them away until you get to the point where you can't stand it any longer. It's like Mozart's father playing half a chord on the piano, and Mozart had to get up out of bed as a child and finish that chord. You get to a point where you want to go in a different direction.
Yeah.
And you don't want to really leave what you're done, so you get this kind of gradual change.
So there's been that kind of evolution?
There's
in
been an evolution. It doesn't mean that I've really stopped with what I had been doing, but over the past 5 years, something that started out as a curiosity that came from my gardening and that a friend sent me on something called scholar rocks, Chinese scholar rocks.
Oh, really?
And as a figurative artist, although there's always an abstract background to my work, I see images. And I thought, you know, maybe it's time for me to look at something that isn't just images and try to deliberately do something that is not reminiscent of figurative images.
So what's this scholar rock?
Well, it's fascinating. Actually, the Chinese invented abstract art. Back as early as the 9th century, they had a fascination with strange and unusual, peculiarly shaped rocks that...
So just rocks found in nature. We're not talking about sculpture.
We're talking about rocks found in nature.
Right.
However, as they have investigated and done major exhibits of it, they've found that some of the rocks, which were could be quite expensive, they would trade rocks, sell rocks.
Really?
They collected them. And at first they were very large rocks that were in a garden. And, of course, they were in the emperor's garden.
Right.
Well, then the scholars wanted their own. And many of these were like microcosms of their world. They were small examples, as if we would take a photograph of a of our family and we'd put it on the desk.
Right.
Well, of course, it's not the size of our family, but it represents our family. And we look at it, it gives us all kinds of memories. They discovered and found and dug up small rocks that looked like the big ones in the garden. They had lots of holes. They were very weird, and they gave them all kinds of wonderful names that meant weird-shaped rock,
crazy rock.
But
they were just fascinated with the shapes.
They were fascinated with the shape. At the same time, those shapes reminded them maybe of mountains or of the caves where the gods were supposed to live. So it also had kind of ritual.
So how did you start using these?
Well, I was laying a brick path in my front yard. Couldn't afford to have somebody else do it. It was very therapeutic. And as I dug up the old concrete, I found in my 1909 house that whereas today they use gravel under the concrete, back then they used slag from out of a coal furnace. And I found these wonderful hand-sized rocks. And I looked at them and I said, this is just like a scholar rock. And I just I dug them all up. I kept them. I ground some of them. I cleaned them. I began to change them a little bit. I put wax on them, put some colors on them. And one of the wonderful things about the Scholar Rocks is that the bases that they sat on were made specifically for each rock, so that they became one. Mm-hmm. Whereas today we take a sculpture, we stick it on a block of wood, paint it white or black, and the pedestal has very little to do with the sculpture. Mm-hmm. So this was a fascinating idea. Not only this abstraction, but also the idea that the pedestal for the rock was part of the mm-hmm, sculpture. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I realized that this was going to be hard for my friends, the community, to understand.
Those
Tim Bowring, who are art historians again, are very aware of Scholar Rocks, but we don't have any yet in our museum. For many years I think they were considered sort of a garden, but there have been some very famous artists like Richard Rosenblum who got so fascinated with them that he had a huge collection, many of which he left to the Metropolitan Museum and the Botanical Garden in Washington.
So is this in part of rock gardens?
In many cases, yes. And it's also connected quite often with bonsai.
Yeah, which abstract forms.
You know,
that's interesting.
So
that's really, yeah.
I'm a member of the bonsai.
Oh, are you?
Society now. Yeah, and Richard. You know, you just
you have bonsai trees.
I'm terrible with plants.
Really?
But it is.
So you have a lot of dead bonsai trees around?
Yes, I really do. And that started the next phase.
Right.
Because in order to make these rocks that I had found and remade, I started taking pottery classes from Stephen Glass at the, mm-hmm. to make handmade bases to go with the rocks. And I also started saving dead bonsai and all kinds of roots from my garden.
Right.
As a scavenger, I just can't throw anything away.
Right, okay.
And so I would look at these roots and I would say, there must be something I mm-hmm. can look at this wonderful shape. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I would take these roots into my studio and start gluing them, carving them, mm-hmm. putting wax on them. Mm-hmm. And from there, I ended up not only with over 100 Scholar Rocks,
right.
most of them very miniature, mm-hmm. but over 100 small sculptures made from roots.
What did you call those?
Those I called earth bones because they have the Chinese names for Scholar Rocks.
Hmm.
They felt that rocks were the bones of the earth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as somebody who's worked with archaeology for years painting it, I felt that the bones that were in the mountains, the rocks, all of this was all really tied together somehow or other in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And it just became a natural progression and an obsession.
Yeah, really.
You know, the paintings are still sitting there, and eventually that will start an itch and I will go back and work on some more paintings. But right now,
but really much more 3D sculptural.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Small. Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't have a big studio, and I have many big old pieces of work, and I have...
Well, I'm looking at these images right now, actually, and they're clearly images of bodies, the earth bones ones, excuse me. Any bodies in...
Well, quite often, I will...
Now, is this made from a root and then made with encaustic? And
it's made from a root and then encaustic has been added to it, mm-hmm. or I've glued other pieces of wood together.
Right.
What for me is a challenge is not only working this small, but but also not finishing it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the same thing with the rocks. It was the idea of taking an object that you had found, doing something to it to push it mm-hmm. where you saw, what you saw in it.
Right.
But not making it totally complete. You mm-hmm. want to leave the raw stone. You want to leave the idea of this found piece of wood so that the figures don't always, like the sculptures that we find from classical times, maybe a head's missing, maybe right. a limb is missing. Yeah. But this also, in a roundabout way, has a lot to do with what I see on the news, with the war
mm-hmm.
and the many soldiers that are coming mm-hmm. back,
mm-hmm.
minus limbs.
Yeah.
It isn't a prominent part of the work, but it's there.
Yeah.
It's an awareness of what's going on and
present earth,
roots, beauty in something beauty, unfinished, wabi-sabi sort of
right.
of a beauty in something that is decaying,
mm-hmm.
that is temporary,
mm-hmm.
like all of life.
Like us.
Yes.
Yes, which I think is a wonderful way to end this, actually. Thank you very, very much. If you can believe it, we're out of time. It zooms by. I want to thank you folks who've tuned in and have listened to us today on Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowring, and once again, you're listening to 97.3 FM. And I've been talking with Suzanne, who is an artist. And how else would you describe yourself, Suzanne? I mean, I know yours, but you've also taught and done workshops.
Oh,
and
I'm a scavenger.
You're a scavenger. Wonderful. And a scavenger. A wonderful scavenger. And thank you for sharing some, at least a part of your journey with us about that. Thank you, Suzanne.
Thank you.